It has always been true, but never more true than it is right now. The pictures you enjoy most are based on the most widely read novels. Recall Grapes of Wrath, Gone with the Wind, How Green Was My Valley, This Above All, Rebecca, great pictures, all of them. And now 20th Century Fox brings you Jane Eyre, based on the most widely read novel in our language, printed and reprinted 100 times, most recently by the Book of the Month Club. Its immortal lovers are played by the most discussed celebrity in the entertainment world, and the actress who won the Academy Award in Suspicion.
Whatever happens, do not open a door. Either door.
Allowed up here. Understand? No one. Get thee down. Get thee down.
Jane, strange, almost unearthly thing. You that I love as my own flesh.
Don't mock me.
I blow off a blush. It's you I want. Answer me, Jane, quickly. Say, Edward, I'll marry you. Say it, Jane. Say it.
I want to read your face.
Read quickly. Say, Edward, I'll marry you.
To the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about the 1943 version of Jane Eyre, starring my favorite guy in the world, Orson Welles, is a new guest of the show, Stella, from the Batgirl to Oracle podcast. Stella, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, and I absolutely see this as my potential audition, because I remember in the previous Who's Who 88, you're kind of ready to get rid of Shag, and so I'm ready to fill those ginormous shoes, if need be.
It's a low bar that you've set for yourself, but we'll see how you can do.
I mean, okay.
You know, all right, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm always up for a replacement. I'm always in the market for one. So anyway, as I said, we're going to be talking about the 1943 version of Jane Eyre. There are, of course, many, many movie versions of this film. This one is, I think, the only one I've ever seen, and that's because it's got Orson Welles in it. For any of you who have not read the book, and I'm assuming that's a lot of you, I have not read the book. The plot is basically little orphan Jane Eyre lives with her cruel aunt, played by Agnes Moorehead. She's then sent off to Lowood Institution. Jane thinks that this is going to be a better life, but unfortunately it is run by the cruel headmaster, Reverend Brocklehurst, Henry Danielle. He seems to hate children, at one point forcing Jane and her only friend Helen, a young Elizabeth Taylor, to go out and walk in the rain as punishment, even though Helen is sick with pneumonia. She eventually dies, leaving Jane all alone. Eventually, young Jane Eyre grows up to be played by Joan Fontaine and tries to become a governess. She gets a job at Thornfield, a gloomy castle owned by Edward Rochester, Orson Welles. As she cares for Rochester's ward, Adele, Margaret O'Brien from Meet Me in St. Louis, she begins to develop feelings for Rochester, even though he seems haunted and distant. Eventually, he reciprocates the feelings, and Jane and Edward plan to marry, until she learns that her beloved is already married to a dangerously unstable woman who is locked up inside the castle. Will Jane and Rochester's love survive? And that is the hook of Jane Eyre. So, Stella, when we talked about you coming on the show, you said any version of Jane Eyre you wanted to talk about. And I picked this one, like I said, because it's Orson Welles. I love Orson Welles. So what is it about Jane Eyre in particular, and what about this version that you like so much?
Yeah, reader, I married him, which is the ending. Jane Eyre, along with Gone with the Wind, are my two favorite pieces of literature. And focusing, you know, on Jane Eyre, I just have such a love for this particular character. She's feisty, which I think, you know, you see in the very beginning with Brocklehurst, you know, saying, how do you prevent going to hell? And she says, well, I don't, you know, I don't become sick. I don't die. You see that a little bit. She fights against things with humor as well as, you know, she doesn't like to readily accept things. But also she's just such a strong, I think, female character. Of course, there is sort of this submissiveness which she has with Rochester. But the fact that she does have moral inclinations, you know, to do the right thing through and through, because he, of course, is offering to marry her. And even after she learns the secret, he offers, you know, let's still get married, you know, or let's live together in secret. And she just does not want that. So the fact that she can stand up, even though she really wants to be with Rochester, but she goes and does what is right, I think is just, she's just a wonderful, I think, female character that we've sometimes lost, I think, in literature with just, I kind of think about Bella from Twilight,
right,
which I'm
sure
you've not read or seen. But
I know,
like,
she mopes a lot. I know that character, right?
Yeah, and you know, follows the man around and everything. But just, you know, a woman that has her own mind. She's got, you know, a guiding sense of what's right and wrong. And I just think she's a very intelligent character. So it's one of those books that I can continue to reread and really enjoy it and learn more from it and get something new out of each time I read it.
Yeah, I mean, she, again, she's played as a young child by the actress named Peggy Ann Garner, who I'm not terribly familiar with, but she's really feisty, you said. She is put upon on this movie. I mean, the Agnes Moorehead plays the aunt, and the aunt just clearly hates children. I mean, she just has no time for Jane Eyre. And then when they send her off to Lowood, Brocklehurst, played by, and Henry Danielle always played dicks pretty much in almost every movie. He was always a real fastidious, mean son of a bitch. He's in a great movie called The Body Snatcher with Boris Karloff, and he's a jerk in that one. And so this is sort of the perfect role. I mean, yeah, he's just, he seems to hate all the children. I mean, he's always complaining about them and that they need to be controlled and quite, you know. And there's a scene where a doctor comes to visit, and the doctor is, you know, vaguely sympathetic to the children. Mm-hmm. And at one point he looks outside because he wants to look after Helen, because Helen has kind of like a thing in her lungs. And he looks outside, and the poor girls are carrying these giant wood, like, bars in the rain. And it's like, it looks like something out of like Conan the Barbarian. I mean, they're being tortured, and the doctor's like, what are you doing? Get these children in. What's the matter with them? He's like, well, they need to be punished. And he's like, I don't care about that. Get these children. And then, of course, I said, poor Helen dies. And it's really powerfully sad to see, you know, poor Jane Eyre's only friend, played by, I guess, you know, again, a young Elizabeth Taylor, who was already at that age luminous.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's some, it's a little creepy, but apparently Orson Welles said at the time, like, you know, come find me again when you're an adult. You know, just like,
it's
a little creepy. But, you know, I mean, it really is quite powerful to see someone who, you know, is going to be this huge star you know, die as a child. It's a really gloomy film. And the reason that I sought this out when I first found it, which was when I was back in the 90s when I worked in a video store, was because it had Orson Welles. I mean, I love everything Orson Welles has done, even the stuff that's not very good. But this is one of those movies that I probably never would have checked out had he not been in it. But man, I love it because it feels like a Orson Welles production. I mean, it said Agnes Moorehead is in it. She was in Citizen Kane. Another actor named Erskine Sanford is in it, who was also in Citizen Kane. He's the guy who comes and delivers the news that Rochester's married. John Houseman, Orson Welles' longtime partner on the Mercury Theater, co-wrote the script. And Bernard Herrmann does the music, who also did Citizen Kane. So this is really a very Orson Welles-y production for a movie that he did not, quote-unquote, direct. Mm-hmm. It fits in with his sort of aesthetic, and it's a beautiful movie to look at. I mean, it's gloomy and dark and gothic. I mean, it doesn't look to me all that dissimilar from what I saw Guillermo del Toro tried to do with the last movie he just did. I'm blanking out on the name of it, but Crimson Peak. That was sold as a horror movie, but everyone I know that saw it said it's really it's a gothic romance, not a horror film. Mm-hmm. And this really does have some wonderful visuals to it, which is not something I would have expected out of Jane Eyre, I guess.
Yeah, and that's one of the wonderful things. That's I actually like sort of the gothic tales, like Mysteries of Udolpho and Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen, which is actually more of a satire on it. But just the fact that it's more of a, you know, we're following Jane Eyre through all these trials and tribulations, and really all she wants, I think, is to be loved and find someone to love, no matter what that is. I mean, it could just be familial, because obviously her uncle, who doted on her, is dead now. Mrs. Reed is a very hateful person, and her cousins, in the book, there are actually three cousins. There's the boy cousin, and two others are just hateful creatures. And then she finally finds, you know, Helen Burns, who is, you know, this very Christian ideal of someone who is loving in all circumstances, and, you know, and then she dies, and then she finds herself in this house, and I think she finds love first with Adele, and then Rochester a little bit. He kind of plays the game, and then that's taken away from her, so it's so sad. So you can kind of see it as a romance, but then you have this, like, mystery, like, what is this weird stuff that's going on behind the scenes? And that's kind of nice, too, for people who may not necessarily be into romantic tales. You kind of have that gothic horror aspect to it. Like, what's going on? What's this deeper story behind, you know, why was Mason attacked? What's going on with mm-hmm. Grace Poole? So I think there's a hook for all ages, or I guess I shouldn't say all ages. I think for man and woman alike, potentially.
How does this stack up in your mind to the book? Because this movie's only like 95 minutes, so I'm imagining it really cuts a lot out.
It does. There are sort of three acts to Jane Eyre. Her as a child, and of course you could split that between Reed and then her school time, and then her as a governess, and then what they don't show is really after she ran away, she doesn't go back to Mrs. Reed. That happened in the book, that happened when she was at Rochester's. She actually runs away and becomes very ill because she gets caught in a rainstorm, is all, I think, Victorian. you know, heroines need to. And she gets picked up by St. John Rivers and his sisters, and they take care of her, and she's going under some other name. And there's sort of a romantic subplot there, though it's more out of duty because he's going to become a missionary in India, and he says that she can certainly fit this missionary life, and so he's trying to make her his wife, and then she runs away. She kind of has this image, like we see at the end of this one, of, you know, Rochester calling to her, and then she goes and finds him. So they cut out that third act altogether, which was a little strange, just because it is an interesting growth to see how she relates to someone that's giving her an idea of affection, like his idea of affection, though it's somewhat misplaced. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's, you know, it's kind of rounded out in a good way. She doesn't really meet any resolution with Mrs. Reed, which was a little disappointing in this film, because at least Mrs. Reed on her deathbed sort of does realize, or she confesses that she didn't treat her as she ought to, because her husband told her, you know, as he was on his deathbed, to take care of her. So she does somewhat apologize to her, and there wasn't really that resolution there. But they did bring it back to, of course, you know, Rochester in the end, and they had that passionate kiss, which was a little violent when I saw it this time. I forgot. I was like, whoa, I was a little taken aback by the violent passion of that particular kiss. But I guess that's Orson Welles for you.
Yeah. I mean, when they decide to get married, there's literally a lightning bolt comes down and hits a tree.
There you go.
And, yeah. I guess that's what it was like to kiss Orson Welles or something. I don't know. What do you make of the central romance? Because it's like Orson, I love Orson, as I've said, mm-hmm. but he's a giant ham. And he's wearing a big fake nose in this movie for no discernible reason other than I think he wanted to. His intro is ridiculously overdramatic. He's riding a horse. And Jane accidentally is in the way when the horse, and so the horse rears, and there's all this dramatic music sting, and, you know, I mean, and he's big in this movie. He's mm-hmm. he talks kind of like this, and every line is delivered, and he's really reaching for the, you know, swinging for the fences, while Joan Fontaine is very reserved, very mm-hmm. quiet. I mean, almost passive in a weird way, and I just wonder about, like, is it they seem to be destined because that's the story of the movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether, you know, in the book, is the romance a little more palatable? Because, you know, if you step outside, you're a little like, why would she be so attracted to this guy? I mean, I know that part of it is security.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a nasty way. I mean, the poor girl's had a rough life, and he's got this castle, and he speaks very romantically, but he's weird. I mean, he's mm-hmm. off-putting, and he speaks very elliptical, in a elliptical manner. I have a hard time finding why Jane Eyre is so enraptured with this guy when he's just so strange.
Yeah, I would say that's interesting hearing it, you know, from a person's perspective that has watched this. And let me first tell you that, and my mother and I agree on this fact, that Orson Welles is probably the best picture of Mr. Rochester that we've had.
Okay.
Now, I've not seen every adaptation, but I've seen many. And he's not supposed to be an attractive character. That is not in his description. And Orson Welles, while I think there is like a strange attractiveness to him, is not the most attractive actor out there. But I mean, they've cast like Timothy Dalton in this role. Toby Stevens, who was, I think that's his last name, who is in Die Another Day from the James Bond series. And then recently they had Magneto. His name is
escaping. Oh, Michael Fassbender.
Yeah. And I mean, these are attractive actors who, you know, don't really fit the bill. They may be like tall, dark, and, you know, but they shouldn't really be handsome. Joan Fontaine, I think she may be too beautiful for this particular role, because Jane is supposed to be pretty plain. And even though she doesn't have any makeup on, like, I still feel like she's very pretty. But I think it may be one of those things of opposites attract. You're saying he's hamming it up, but that's like completely what his role is. I love that he's very much someone who, if he were on a Broadway stage, would not need a microphone at all.
Nope.
He's just like, you know, enunciating his lines and you could totally hear it. And that's just his presence and being that large human being. I think he very much fills that role. And it's tough because, you know, in a movie that's not going to adapt the whole, they're going to make it as accessible to audiences as possible, you don't necessarily see as much a growth of his character as there is. But just in their daily, you know, their conversations and everything, his heart starts to change. And I think you may see this most physically in this particular film with how he starts treating Adele. Because at the very beginning, he just really doesn't want anything to do with her. But then he has more patience with her, and I think he dotes on her a little bit more. So I think through Jane, he begins to soften and open his heart. And I think for Jane, it's nice to have a companion. And he has a quick tongue. And I think like that, their wit is complementary. So I think that's one of the reasons why. But of course, I mean, I think because the author, you know, wants them to be together, of course, they're going to be somewhat shoehorned into this path where they're going to fall in love. But I think for me, it is sort of like a opposites attract situation. And they both change each other in different ways.
Yeah, that's interesting you mentioned about his relationship with his ward, because I said Adele is his ward, and she's Margaret O'Brien from Tootie from Meet Me in St.
Yes.
Louis. She's great. She's great in this movie. She's great in everything. But it's, yeah, he sort of basically outsources her care to somebody else, and that's right. The woman that Jane spends most of her time with. And then it isn't until about, I don't know, almost not halfway, but pretty close to halfway, that she even meets Rochester. And when they first meet, he doesn't even say who he is. And there's no, they don't recognize, you know, she mentions that she's the governess of this household, and he just is like, yes, okay. And then he rides off on his horse, and at no point does he say, you work for me, actually. I'm Rochester. He chooses to be sort of mysterious and strange.
It's that air of mystery, yeah. And that does happen, you know, and he says, you bewitched my horse and all that crazy stuff. But yeah, I think it's pretty fun when she walks in and then she sees Pilot, and she's kind of already on alert, like, what is going on? Yeah.
Yeah, this movie was directed by Robert Stevenson, who I mentioned. Now, Robert Stevenson, to this point, this is one of his earliest films. He doesn't have, well, let me show you one of his earliest. He has about 10 movies to his credit before this. None of them terribly distinguished one way or the other. And then it was later on, he became just the Disney guy. He directed in the 60s, The Absent-Minded Professor, In Search of the Castaways, Son of Flubber, That Darn Cat, The Gnomobile, The Love Bug, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Herbie Rides Again, The Shaggy D.A., and a little movie called Mary Poppins. So, I mean, the guy certainly had a distinguished career, but there's nothing in his visual style that suggests he did this movie in a lot of ways. And part of the reason that I've always sort of fascinated by Orson Welles is that there's lots of projects that he clearly stepped behind the camera to help out with, but then did not take credit. And this feels like one of his movies. I mean, it has a lot of those that chiaroscuro kind of element to it, mm-hmm. and a lot of the Citizen Kane shadows and mist and all this stuff. And that's what, to me, gave it, you know, that was my initial attraction to it when I first watched it, was like, wow, this is really a visually compelling kind of movie. Now, does the book have those sorts of gothic elements? I've never read it, but I've never known or heard Jane Eyre described that way, that it's like that it has that gothic element to it.
It is, yeah. And mostly it's because of this setting, because, you know, it's a castle, basically, but it's not like a very pleasant castle. It is somewhat derelict. And there aren't necessarily, I would have to reread again, but to see as many servants as there are in the film, I felt like that was not correct, because there aren't as many servants on staff, because they don't really need to be. And of course, the wife is like the main element that makes it so gothic. So I think when you walk into this castle, it's not really well used because he's traveling a lot. And then I think you can tell really that there's something going on, because it is so dark and unhappy. And even Mrs. Fairfax says, you know, it's a very gloomy living situation that she has, not only because she doesn't have anyone to talk to really, except for the servants, which is a bit of a dig for them because she too is a servant. But, you know, I think that there's clearly something dark going on. And so no one can really have this peace of mind because, you know, Grace Poole is guarding this secret.
Now, the screenplay, again, I mentioned it was earlier, was written, co-written by John Houseman, which was Orson Welles' frequent collaborator. It was also partly co-written by Aldous Huxley.
Oh, my goodness.
From Brave New World, which is man, movies in the 40s just had that. You know, you're like, they got these renowned authors. So it's like, oh, yeah, by the way, we've got Ernest Hemingway working on the screenplay. Aldous Huxley. I don't know why he would have any connection to Jane Eyre, but he did work on this. And, you know, it's sort of interesting to me about, like, that he would be put on this project. And I have to wonder, as an author himself, I wonder what he felt about transposing someone else's words into a screenplay. Because, again, there's a lot of changes here. I don't know if they've ever made any movies based on his books. I'm not that familiar with his work outside of Brave New World. Mm-hmm. But I always have to wonder, like, you know, when you're – I guess maybe at that point Jane Eyre was already sort of an established title. It wasn't like there wasn't any rights you had to worry about. Charlotte Bronte had long since – died. So I guess you could just put it in the Hollywood sort of meat grinder and just do what you needed to do for it or anything. But I mean, I feel like it gets across the main thrust of the story, you know, mm-hmm. like I didn't feel, I mean, I know you said that, there's a lot of changes to the book, but I've seen other versions and it feels as though that at least the main idea of the story, what they're trying to get across, is here, even though, like I said, the movie's fairly brief, you know, mm-hmm. 95 minutes.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think that you see the growth. I think you see Jane and all the troubles that she's been through, and that this isn't necessarily a happy story. And then you see the growth between her and Rochester. They're separate characters as well as a relationship. And then, you know, her running off and then her coming back. So I think it does touch on everything that it needs to.
Do you have you've said you haven't seen them all, but I mean, there's so many. Do you have another version that you prefer more, or do you think is your favorite version?
This is actually, you know, once I watched this again, I realized that I very much enjoy this one. I think it, I don't know if timeless is the correct word for it, because I feel like, though, you could watch it now, and it works really well. I think the actors did such a wonderful job, and it's not like it's something that was contemporary at the time it was made. So it's something, you know, so it's something that can always be remade and it's always going to be in this particular time period. So I do really like this one. I am a fan of the recent one with Michael Fassbender and Mia Wasikowska.
Nice. You said that right off the tongue. That was good.
Thanks.
That's tough to say.
And one of the, I kind of go back and forth, but just it's not necessarily a linear storytelling. Have you seen that adaptation?
No, I've not seen that one.
Okay. So it does kind of use backflashes because she appears at St. John's doorstep, and then she's sort of remembering all of these things. But they do all three acts, which I think is wonderful. I have seen the Timothy Dalton one, and I think that's a good one. But again, Timothy Dalton is a very attractive man. and the one with Toby Stevens was good as well, but there's sort of this weird seduction scene that I had problems with. Like, it really ruffled my feathers because I'm like, Jane Eyre would not put herself in this situation. So, you know, there's never, I have a button that says, you know, don't judge the don't judge movies by my book. No, wait, don't judge my book by the movies, you know, like the adaptations and things like that. And I think that's true. I don't know if I'll ever be 100% happy with, you know, with Jane Eyre, any of the films that come out. But this one, I really enjoy this one, and I really enjoy the most recent one.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about book adaptations, because my favorite book of all time is The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham. And there are two movie versions of that, both of which I enjoy quite thoroughly. I plan to cover them on the show at some point, but neither one of them really quite goes anywhere near the book. And I would hate for people to be like, kind of judge the book without seeing the movies, because it's like, they're not exactly the same. I think they're good on their own terms, but they're not the book.
I just read that. It's funny you said that. I just read that like a month or two ago and loved the book. And it's on my DVR. It's been on it for a long time. I have I'm not sure which version it is, probably the later one, I guess, if there are two of them. But I was reading the info and I'm like, oh, this does not seem like what the book is about. So now I'm going to have to. And so I've been holding off and watching it because I didn't want to be annoyed by, it's like he chases after somebody. I don't know.
Yeah, there's one from the 40s, and then there's one from the 80s with Bill Murray, and
The
40s one. Yeah, no, they're both really interesting movies. It's just the book is just, to me, got so much more in it, and there's an, it's, we'll have to do that on a whole other show, but there's an essential element to the book that needed to me neither movie has ever been able to try and get. It didn't even try to get, and that's the part where I'm like, just read the book, just just judge the two things on its own. Now we're getting off Jane Eyre, but I have to, what made you want to read The Razor's Edge, like out of kind of nowhere like that?
I actually have this huge reading list of books that I want to get through before I die, and that happened to be on there. It's true, that happened to be on there, and I really enjoyed that. And what is so interesting about this, we really are getting off topic, but what's really interesting about that particular book is that the main character is like, what, in 20%, you know, of the book?
Yeah,
like the whole thing is focused on this guy, but it's really about, you know, finding out and learning about this character through other people and their interactions with him. And he only is like appearing. And the fact that Somerset Maugham is in the novel as well, which I thought was pretty cool. But no, that was, I love that book. Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. I think it's the only fiction book that I've read. Well, not the only one, but it's one of the few fiction books I've read more than once. I tend to read, I don't read a lot of fiction. I read nonfiction, and fiction books I read once and I go, okay, and I put it away and I never read. But I've read The Razor's Edge probably 20 or 30 times at this point. I dig it out every so. I buy different editions of it. I collect them, actually, and I have different versions. I have all sorts of crazy ones in other languages that I don't read. It's a very, very strange thing. So, I know, getting back to Jane Eyre before we sort of wind up on this. Look, when did you first read Jane Eyre? Did you read it as a kid?
I did not read it. Well, I guess like under 18, yes, if that's what you consider.
I'd say that's a kid, sure.
Okay, yeah. And this was also on my reading list. I was like, well, I guess I'll read this Jane Eyre. And I read it, and I absolutely loved it. And then I went over to her sister, and I read Wuthering Heights, and I absolutely did not like that one. So I think there are differences there. But yeah, I just really grasped on to the first person. Oh, well, I mean, to this particular character and just her how strong she is. I mean, you know, if I'm to get a little, only a little bit religious on this show,
so go right, go right
so
ahead.
People don't cut off or anything, but with all of the bad stuff that she went through and coming from Christian people, you know, especially Brocklehurst and all of this bad stuff, you would expect Jane Eyre to just be like, I'm done with this and turn away and be, you know, whatever type of person she is. But just the fact that she can kind of sift through, I think, all the bad stuff. And I don't think she completely is, you know, through and through, you know, on this Christian path necessarily. But with all the hateful stuff that – and those are sort of the worst Christians, unfortunately, that just are very terrible to you because they think you're a terrible person. But she's able to endure all that and just move on from it and is still a lovely human being. And I think that's just such a wonderful message. And has like good morals, like I said at the beginning, you know, good moral inclinations, whereas anyone else could just be turned off and is like, that's Christianity, I'm not going that way, and do their own thing. So that's another reason why I really like Jane Eyre.
Interesting.
And I had a question for you. What did you think about how they actually take sections from the novel and showed it, you know, and Joan Fontaine was narrating, she would read over it, and then they would go into a new scene or section of the film. How did you like that?
Oh, I liked it. I mean, that's a style that I'm used to from older films, where they would sort of make it, it's almost literally chapters. You know, it's like, okay, now we're going to move on to this, especially a book that's so renowned. Even by the 1940, Jane Eyre was a renowned title. And so, no, I fully appreciate that style. I mean, I really was hooked into this character. Again, Peggy Ann Garner is terrific as the young Jane Eyre. And I mean, there's a heartbreaking scene where after they ship her off to Brocklehurst and she's in that the carriage with, yep, with the guy, and she's all chipper. She's like, oh, my life's going to be so much better. I'm going to be – and they're going to take care of me and they're going to feed me. And he's like, oh, well, where are you going? And she goes, Lulwood. And the guy just said – his face just falls because he knows what's coming, and we see it. And she doesn't see it. And it's really heartbreaking because you're like, oh, no, this poor kid. And, you know, again, Agnes Moorehead is just so cruel to little Jane Eyre. And it's interesting. I don't know how, you know, what the casting is involved again, or how much Orson Welles was involved. But like in Citizen Kane, Agnes Moorehead is Charles Foster Kane's mother, and she only has one scene, but she is the ultimate in good mother. She cares so much for her child. She wants to get young Charlie away from the father, who clearly beats him, and she is willing to sacrifice her own happiness and her own life to send Charles Foster Kane away, to get him away from this terrible man. And then to see her be so cruel here is almost upsetting, because I'm just so familiar with her from Citizen Kane. And here she's verbally cruel. You have to assume that she's physically cruel too, though we never actually see that. But
well, she's stuck in this isn't Harry Potter, sir. And she's stuck in that closet.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
At the
right.
very beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, and like you said, the fact that she is so sort of indefatigable, and like she is a good person, and she, the minute she is shown a little bit of kindness from Helen, they take to each other immediately. You know, I mean, there's a thing where Brocklehurst like is inspecting your teeth and stuff. I mean, it's like a scene out of Full Metal Jacket. I mean, he's all got them all standing there, and he's, you know, it's really, I'm kind of like, I remember thinking of this when I first saw it, and again when I watch it, it's like, it's almost kind of shocking how cruel the movie shows these kids to be, because you just feel like they would have soft pedaled it a little for 1943, 44, but they really don't. They really do get again, with them out in the rain and the poor kid dies of pneumonia, you really are like, boy, they are just utterly cruel. And the fact that she grows up to be Joan Fontaine, who retains this sort of aura of solemnity, even when, like, there's a scene where she's talking with Brocklehurst where she says, I'm going to be a governess. And he's like, who would hire you as a governess? You know? And then, you know, she's like, well, I've sent out numerous, you know, entreaties to people to hire me. And he's like, no one's going to hire you. And then you see that there's like 20 invitations to her to be a governess. And he's been hiding them this whole time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, even when she's grown up, even when she has proven to be a nice person, Brocklehurst still hates her guts because she's independent, because she thinks for herself. And that's, you know, you can't help but completely fall in love with her in a nice way of like, well, you just want her to survive. You want her to thrive because she's just such a decent person.
Right. And I think no better scene shows what her life in Lulwood is going to be than at the very beginning, where like her introduction, her sort of hazing is, we're going to make you stand on this chair for 24 hours. And, you know, the symbolism of like students turn your back on her and don't give her any help, and they do, and then they walk off and let her. And I think that's when, you know, you realize that she went from one hell to a different kind of hell. And yeah, it's just about survival, I think. But how wonderful just to have that olive branch come from Helen Burns, you know, in the form of a piece of bread. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it said it's wonderfully played by Elizabeth Taylor. But yeah, I've always
liked, uncredited. What's
uncredited
up with that?
Yeah, well, I guess back then they were like, and she had just finished or about to do National Velvet or something, so it wasn't like she was unknown. But Joan Fontaine had a wonderful career, just kept going, and she lived to be 96. God bless her. Her sister, the other famous sister, Olivia de Havilland, is still with us. She's going to be 100. This year, which is remarkable. So these two had an amazing career, and apparently Olivia de Havilland played Charlotte Bronte in some other movie. So mm-hmm. they both have this connection to Charlotte Bronte. I mean, these two famous sisters played famous sisters, you know. Mm-hmm. You said Wuthering Heights was written by the other Bronte. It was written by which one? Emily?
Or was yeah.
It? Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of amazing,
that
really.
That one's a little weird, and it's been a while since I've said it, so I don't know if I can necessarily comment on it, but I feel like the lead, Catherine, is just sort of the polar opposite of who Jane is, but it's got that same gothic horror aspect
right.
So.
Yeah, I've never actually seen the film version either, so that's something I'll have to check out. So, but yeah, so it's Jane Eyre. It's a really terrific movie. I think it's good for virtually anybody to watch.
So.
You know, it's safe for families. There's nothing there, but it's got a lot of complex stuff to it, and you know, he's a great central character. And again, I always enjoy Orson Welles hamming it up. I just never tire of that guy. He's just I always feel like he's just winking at the audience all the time, in sort of a good way. And visually, I think it's a real treat. And like I said, at like 96 minutes, it just zips right by. You know, it's a really wonderful little movie. So I think, is that going to be it for Jane Eyre? Do we have anything else we want to say about it?
No, I'm just shocked that this is pretty early on in his career. Like, he hasn't really done many films before this, talking Orson Welles.
Yeah, he was only 2 years out from Citizen Kane at this point.
Yeah.
And he was doing a lot of these jobs to pay the – already at this age to sort of pay the bills, because he wanted mm-hmm. to fund his movies. He had already had another movie, The Magnificent Ambersons, which – in my opinion, is of equal to Citizen Kane in terms of its quality. It had been savaged by the studio, and he was already sort of suffering from there. So he started taking, as he called it, money jobs to fund his other movies. But he really gives his all here, and he's terrific, and he's a lot of fun. And I, you know, the putty nose thing just makes you feel like he's just goofing around. He always liked to appear in some augmented way one way or the other, so he's having a little bit of a laugh here, even though, like I said, the performance is quite fun to watch. So, and everybody else is good. Said Fontaine is good, Margaret O'Brien is good, Henry Danielle is his usual dickish self. So I mean, it's just everybody across the board is really well done, and good job for Robert Stevenson. Again, he didn't go on to do a lot of other stuff like this. He moved on to Herbie the Love Bug and things like that, but this is a solid directorial effort, no matter how much Orson Welles was involved. So So yeah, I think we're going to wrap it up here for Jane Eyre. Stella, thank you for coming on and doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me on. One of my favorites.
Awesome. Where can people find you on the internet?
Absolutely. You can find me over at thebatmanuniverse.net. I do my own show, Batgirl the Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast, where I'm tracing Barbara Gordon's history. And I'm just starting to step into Birds of Prey. I've done the first two one-shots with her. And I also do the bi-monthly comic podcast for the Batman Universe. And then you can also find me over on the monthly podcast, Comic Book Film Review, where we look at films that are based off of comic books.
Awesome. We will talk about this off air, but you've passed the audition. And
yes,
the contract will be in the mail shortly.
Yeah.
I have to talk to Shag first about a few things.
Okay.
And he's got to find out.
It's never good to get news from someone else.
Yeah, and he doesn't listen to this show, so therefore he's not going to know it's coming, which
okay.
will be fun in its own way. So, yeah, if you want to contact us, you can go to Fire and Water Network, fireandwaterpodcast.com, use the contact page, or, of course, leave a comment on the individual show thread. And you can follow the show on Twitter, which is Film and Water Pod. So, Stella, once again, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad I had the chance to watch this movie again. I hadn't seen it in decades, and it was a lot of fun to watch it over.
Yeah.
Very cool. So thank you so much. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Lux presents Hollywood. The Lux Radio Theater brings you Orson Welles and Loretta Young in Jane Eyre. Ladies and gentlemen, your producer, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille.
Greetings from Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. This is the beginning of a busy week for me, with Gary Cooper in the story of Dr. Wassel opening in New York tomorrow night and here in Hollywood on Wednesday. And tonight, the week is certainly off to a wonderful start, with two of our town's most accomplished artists in one of the immortal love stories of the English language, Loretta Young and Orson Welles in Jane Eyre. Charlotte Bronte wrote Jane Eyre almost a century ago. And yet in a world at war, this tempestuous story of the emotions is a bigger success than ever, for several new editions of the novel have appeared in the last few months. And the recent 20th Century Fox picture version has been one of the hits of the motion picture year. Tonight, you'll hear Orson Welles as Edward Rochester, the same role he played in the picture. And as the lovely Jane Eyre, we have the lovely Loretta Young. We'll go back to England of the 19th century when a fast sailing packet astonished the world by crossing the ocean in 16 days. A dictator with delusions of world conquest had just been exiled to a small island in the Atlantic Ocean, and the richest duchess in England would have traded all her beauty secrets for one cake of Lux toilet soap. And so if the gay whirl of 19th century society seems more exciting than keeping house, you should remember the Duchess of 1820, who'd be happy to exchange places for an automobile, electric lights, or little modern luxuries like that cake of Lux toilet soap. And here's the warning signal for the curtain to go up on the first act of Jane Eyre, starring Orson Welles as Edward Rochester and Loretta Young as Jane Eyre.